Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
The Killer Bees!
ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 proudly present The Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of The Killer Bees.
Don't sweat the technique.
Now from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Ooh, what a beatdown! Hey, how we doing?
He's Blank, I'm Branham. It's Austin Rodriguez behind the glass. He'll be here the whole week. Brian's lazy bones. We'll do a Where is Brian, really, a little bit later. But he's not with the show the whole week. A busy weekend in sports. We've got lots to get to. Nothing bigger, though, than Rudy T choosing as the recipient of the 2024 Chuck Daly Lifetime Achievement Award. Massive.
It's not massive. Massive. I put it there on there because it's worth mentioning.
Oh, it's you that put that on there.
Yeah, I put that on there because it's worth mentioning.
I guess.
It's a good honor. A lifetime achievement by the Hall of Fame. Yeah, it's a pretty good honor.
Golf clap for Rudy T. That is pretty cool. It is pretty cool.
Wow, you're something else. You miss the day and you come back and you're already starting.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. Astros, good, bad, and ugly. Usually we start with the good when it comes to the Houston Astros after they win a series, but it just didn't feel right. It didn't feel right starting with the good after they lose it in epic fashion yesterday. Up two runs, Ryan Pressly pitches the second game of a back-to-back, 25 pitches the night before. He's not been very good. We'll get into some of the Ryan Pressly stuff, Texans, their stuff. Mailbag Monday, lots to get to. But if this is this the latest worst loss of the season, which, you know, latest worst loss, could it be the worst? If not, which one would be?
To me, it is the worst loss of the season because this is the one where I almost just threw in the towel and jumped off the bridge because of the fact that we've seen so many of these. It's like one of those moments where you say, well, it could have been the Fromber meltdown. You know, you could have been one of the late inning meltdowns when then they didn't have enough relief pitchers or they found other that whole streak early in the season where they were finding ways to lose. But this is a game when, you know, when we had Todd Callis on Friday, we were talking about the fact that he was like, just win series. They don't need to sweep them. But you're in the driver's seat to sweep this series. You got a three-run lead late in the game. You had multiple opportunities to score another run, if not more. You don't do any of those things, and yet you're kind of feeling good like you're still just going to coast and you're going to put this one away, and then you don't. And in the way you do it, it's kind of like the way you started the show. You go into wanting to talk about all the positives of really looking like you were dominating the Angels all weekend. But the only thing you could think of is you should have had a sweep instead of all that positivity and momentum rolling into San Francisco. You feel like you got kicked below the belt, and here we are again.
Yeah, this is – look, I think that we overreact to wins and losses, and it's always like what is the latest that has happened. Overall, you win 2 of 3. That's fine. I agree with Todd. Win series – but it's just the feeling that you leave town with. You board the plane, and it's like, oh, you're this close from getting another win. Like, the Astros closed, like, they made up ground. I think it's 4.5 back in the wild card. Like, they're trending. I don't know if I think that they're trending in the right way. But all I want them to do is win series. So it's hard for me to be overly critical of a team that wins the series. Now, can you break down the last game and talk about all of the things that went wrong there? Yeah. I mean, Ryan Pressly, for all season, really, has been pretty bad. Joe Espada using him in the second day in a row after 20-something pitches whenever they had a 5-run lead the day before. A little bit unlucky there because Alex Bregman gets hurt, gets hit by a pitch on the wrist. He has to leave the game. Mauricio Dubon makes 2 errors that if Bregman's there, he makes the play, you win the game. So, like, there is a lot of factors that come into play. Is this, like, the worst loss of the year? It certainly feels that way. I think that they all matter, obviously. Like, 162 games, they all have the same weight. They all have the same value. Why do we think the one yesterday was the worst of the season? Because it's the most recent. It's the one that's on our minds. It's the one that we have feelings toward. So, yeah, I mean, I think that it can be the worst loss of the season. I think all the losses are bad.
Yeah, no, I do too. But the kind of the bigger picture thing that I was thinking about is the fact that we've had too many of these. you and I constantly were going back and forth, bringing up other examples of how they were inventing ways to lose games early in the season. Like, they were in control of games. They had games right in the palm of their hand, in their grasp, ready to put away to start, at that point, trying to hopefully get it going in the right direction. And then they would just self-destruct right before our eyes, and they would continue to lose. So when you start saying not only is this the latest and the, probably the toughest to take, but when you kind of correlate that to the whole season's overriding theme has been they found ways to lose. They don't put teams away. They don't win games they're supposed to win when they're winning them. It just feels like it might be one of those years, and that's what you got to get over, because you're right. We are prisoners of the moment, and it is the last game that we're dealing with.
Like, if you win 11-1 today, everybody, oh, we're back. The offense is clicking. Spencer Arrighetti was good. Hayter was locked down in the – well, I guess he wouldn't be pitching in the ninth of 11-1 game, although I don't put anything by Joe Espada. Like, everybody would be talking tomorrow, oh, the Astros are back. They're here to stay. Like, this is the reactionary feelings of watching a baseball team over the course of 162. And I feel like the reactions now are, like, bigger. They're, like, hotter takes because the Astros are in a hole. So you see a lot more of the reactionary, oh, this is the worst thing in the world, trade everybody. Like, and I still believe that you should demote Ryan Pressly. I've been feeling that way for the last month and a half. But there's, like, the other, like, trade everybody, blah, 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 blah. Like, we react to every single game in baseball when it's a very long season. I'm not saying the Astros shouldn't have a sense of urgency. They should have had a sense of urgency a month ago. I think you can look at Ryan Pressly when it talks about sense of urgency, maybe move him from the eighth inning, move him out of the setup spot. Chaz McCormick hasn't been playing as much, but he's been reeling. Maybe don't give him the at-bats. Jose Abreu had a good weekend. But at the same point, like, he has been overall bad, and you've been pot committed to give him tons of at-bats. So, like, yes, the Astros should absolutely have a sense of urgency. Should we be as reactionary to a single game or a series? Like, I kind of hesitate there. I have a tough time being so reactionary to a single game. That said, there's a lot of things that happen in a game that you lose where you can certainly have hot takes about, and Ryan Pressly would be chief among them when you're talking about yesterday's game.
No question. I mean, I think we all know that when we get to it, that's the worst, the ugliest, and everything about how it all went down. But you're right. I mean, it's hard to sweep series on the road. It's hard, no matter how bad you think a baseball team is, people quickly forget the Angels won 2 of 3 when they were here. So you were in a position to win. JV didn't pitch his best game, yet you kept putting runs on the board. You put a couple of crooked numbers up between the two innings to really put yourself in a really good position. And then it comes down to just, like, executing baseball that they weren't capable of doing, whether you bunt or not, believe in small ball or not, just get a ball to the right side or you know, get a fly ball here, move guys over there, do some things so that you can at least push one or two runs across so that you can pretty much solidify you're going to get a win. Instead, you leave the door open, and then I have to sit there and watch people on social media and all over the place bitching about the fact that Cabbage was interfered with or they should have had the ball. Shouldn't have come down to that. Shouldn't have been even in that position to have to deal with any of that, but yet, that's where we were.
They were saying he was interfered with?
Yeah, they were saying there's no doubt he caught the ball. It was when he was transferring it out that he got hit, and therefore it should be an out. I'm like, not when you're in the stands to make a catch.
I didn't see that. That's.
I even had friends this morning trying to drop that on me. I was like, no, it's not even arguable.
No, they're entitled to the space outside of the out of the field of play. Almost a heck of a play by Cabbage. That was incredible athleticism to get to it. I thought he had it.
I was convinced he had it because it stayed in the glove until it went below the rail, and it must have just slipped out as he was coming back down off the wall.
Yeah, just didn't hold on to it. That stunk. A really good effort by Cabbage. I don't put a whole lot of blame. Like, you know who Hader's, like, best friend is today? Ryan Pressly. Because Hader gave up a game-winning home run. He gave up a walk-off home run. Yeah, we're talking about Pressly today, and rightfully so. Like, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be talking about Pressly today, but we're not talking about the Josh Hader, and it wasn't a blown save because it was a tie game, but we're not talking about how he gave up the gopher ball that won the game. What other bads did you have? Good, bad, ugly. The bad and the ugly first, because we have a sour taste in our mouths from yesterday's game. 713-780-3776.
Yeah, I think there's plenty. I think Dubon's glove. I mean, you got a gold glove utility player. And as you mentioned, if Bregman unfortunately got hit on the wrist again, and he's been hit on the hand and the wrist, if he doesn't get hit, like you mentioned, we're probably not talking about a loss. We're in a good position. But you always feel good that wherever you put Dubon, he's going to be really solid defensively. And he didn't just have one; he had two errors. They were costly. They were at the exact wrong time, and that those were tough pills to swallow.
Yeah, I had Presley's glove on mine. I firmly believe if Bregman stays in the game yesterday, the Astros win. Because Dubon had two errors that directly led to runs that I don't think happen, and I think that the Astros win that game. Justin Verlander to me. I think it's fair to call Justin Verlander Justin Midlander. Like, you look at his overall numbers, and you look up the Baseball Savant stuff, and I usually do that on Monday mornings. He's been very average. Like, quite frankly, he has been very average this year. And I think it's fair to expect a 41-year-old starting pitcher to be average relative to big league standards. But because the Astros need starting pitching, you factor him into one of your top two starting pitching roles in this starting rotation. Like, it's he and Framber Valdez. They're your two anchors. We might be needing to come to a realization that Justin Verlander's just a guy. Like, he's good. He's solid. He certainly belongs in a big league rotation. He's not washed to the sense that Ryan Presley is washed. And he, like, some people are saying DFA Ryan Presley, which you're going too far if you're saying that. Verlander's nowhere near that discussion. Right. But Verlander has a 3.95 ERA this year. Like, he's barely a sub-4 ERA guy. You pull up some of his Baseball Savant stuff. Incredibly mediocre. Pitching run value in the 50th percentile. That's right down the middle. Some of his pitch value, right down the middle. Like, expected ERA, which I'm not a huge expected number kind of guy. Expected ERA, 54th percentile, right down the middle. Now, where he excels, I think, is his head, his IQ. He's got a very high understanding of the game, and he can get guys out. But we have to come to the realization, I believe, that at the age of 41 years old, that Justin Verlander is a pretty mediocre starting pitcher in 2024.
Yeah, it's, again, I revert back to when we were talking to TK, and he said he was relying on Justin Verlander. And he's like, you know, it's going to be a tough series to win anyway, but you got Verlander. He, you know, he should be good against them, and he's really found his groove. And he thought that the toughest game to win was going to be Saturday. Yet here we are talking about the game. You win the game, but Verlander looked like the worst starting pitcher of the three pitchers this weekend because Framber pitched his tail off, and Hunter Brown pitched his tail off. And Justin Verlander, you would expect, he's dominated the A's before too, that he should get to at least dominate the teams that are less than. And instead, you know, he gives up the one early, then it was three, then he was battling all day, and you're like, that's not what you expect out of your quote-unquote ace. To be the top of your rotation type guy.
Yeah, he's been, and look, I love Verlander. I think he's the greatest Astros starting pitcher in the history of the franchise. Hot take. But at the age of 41, I think we need to pump the brakes on what the expectations for Justin Verlander is. He's a middle of the rotation starter at this point. And like, he'll log some innings. He'll get just through. So he'll have a quality start every now and then. His last two starts against teams that aren't very good, he's had almost the exact same stat line. 4 runs, 7 hits, 5 innings. His strikeouts are down. He had 3 strikeouts against the Angels. He had 4 strikeouts against the Cardinals in a game which he gave up 3 home runs in that game. So the expectations for Justin Verlander need to be realistic. And the front office has to be realistic with it as well. Like, Dana Brown talked to whoever he's talking to that day, whether it's Astros TV on the Shin, whether it's Astros Radio, whether it's with Salisbury, whoever he's talking to. He talks about how Verlander is one of the key pillars in this starting rotation. And look, I know he's going to give you innings, and I know you're going to count on him every fifth day, things like that. But is he a number one, number two on a World Series contender? Probably not. He's probably a number three, probably number four.
I tell you where he is. He is when you got an offense that's supercharged with power and run production to where he he's a very intelligent pitcher. He pitches with between his ears a lot. And he could do that with a very high-powered offensive team. Like, you put him on the Yankees, and the Yankees with that offense, when Soto's in the lineup too, I mean, I'm sure that he could be a number one type guy. But in this situation right now, I mean, he has got to be at his optimal best to be an ace on this team. And the way he's pitching, he's not pitching anything close to it.
No, and it's, I mean, to me, it's just the reality of the situation. Like, when players age, they're going to get worse. And this isn't a bash Justin Verlander. Like, Verlander for this at his age is unbelievable. Like, how many 41-year-old pitchers have a sub-4 ERA, you know, 10 starts into the year? Very, very few. So, like, he is the exception to the rule. He is the elite. He's one of the very few guys that can pitch into his 40s. But at the age of 41, what do you expect Justin Verlander to be? Like, this is probably who he is. He's probably a 3.95 ERA guy, and he's going to have some dominant performances. He's going to have a 7-inning shutout start where he strikes out 8, and it looks like vintage Verlander. But more than likely, he's going to have these lines against the Angels and the Cardinals where he gives up 4 runs, 7 hits, 5 innings, and strikes out a few. that's probably the realistic spot of where Justin Verlander is at. And I don't think the Astros can really do anything about it, because it's not like they can go out and trade for a top two starter. Like, you're kind of pot committed to what you have. You got to hope that Ronel Blanco can be who he has been for the full body of 2024, or that Luis Garcia can be, you know, a really solid starter. Lance McCullers, but the same thing. Like, Verlander isn't a top two starter in a dominant starting rotation anymore, in my opinion.
It's more essential that Fromber finds old Fromber, because Fromber's your ace. Fromber has to be your ace, and then you figure it out from there. Blanco should be your number two. So if Blanco's your number two,
which is still scary. Like, you don't really have a two if that's the case.
Right, because you don't know how effective he's going to be as the season wears on. And when he throws a full season, and all the teams that he's facing are way better than anything he's ever faced, you know, basically throughout his career as a starting pitcher. And you don't know what you don't know. So, yeah, you pencil him in for the number two. Verlander's probably the three. But at the same time, then you're keeping your fingers crossed to either get the young guys to continue to show progress, like Hunter Brown again yesterday, like Arrigetti, who pitches tonight, who's been pitching better, or you start, hoping that not only are they going to be effective, but are they going to be effective, stretched out, and capable in the case of Garcia and McCullers, because those are your options.
Good, bad, ugly. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Mailbag Monday coming up later in the show. Who ruined Ryan Pressly? Steven Nelson's retiring, which is pretty interesting. But who are players that have retired too early? We'll get to all of that. 713-780-3776. Good, bad, ugly. I'll try to get to some of the good. There was some good. There was some good Friday and Saturday, and a little bit of good yesterday up until the eighth inning. We're on Twitch, twitch.tv/ESPN975, on YouTube at ESPN Houston. He's at Pac-Man Joel on Twitter. I'm at Jeremy Branham. It's the Bees on ESPN975, ESPN925.
You're listening to ESPN975. Coming to you live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, it's the Killer Bees
on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Good, bad, and the ugly from the Astros weekend. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776, HR&P listener line. I think they need to push the starting pitchers an extra inning as well and start cleaning house in the bullpen and start fresh. I think Espada pushes his starters quite a bit, actually. Gave Fromber the opportunity to go deep in the game and throw the complete game, which, you look at the advanced numbers, he's not as good in the third or fourth time through the lineup. Joe Espada said, I don't care about your advanced numbers. We're going to have Fromber Valdez save the bullpen, and I think it was a good idea. Sometimes he gives Verlander a little bit of an extra leash. Look, he kept Verlander in the fifth inning when he very easily could have taken him out, and then Verlander had that pitch, the one-out pitch, smashed right to Pena for an inning-ending double play. Didn't miss a bat there, didn't miss a barrel there, but got some help from the defense. And then the offense actually gave him the chance to have the win until Ryan Pressly messed things up. So I don't think that Espada has an issue with leaving or taking starters out too soon. I think some of Espada's criticisms more his usage of the bullpen.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I think to your point, he tries to get everything he can out of his starters. He's constantly trying to look out to save his bullpen. Not that it's been useful or effective with the way that the last three guys have pitched lately, but yeah, I don't think that's an issue. And honestly, I had a lot of people too this morning giving me hell about the middle of the bullpen too. And I was like, but the middle of the bullpen's been the least of your worries. I mean, between Seth Martinez and Taylor Scott, you didn't expect anything from either one of those guys that were going to be significant contributions, and they're both contributing for you.
Yeah, I'm okay with how he handles his starters. I mean, the bullpen, I'm like okay-ish with. I don't love the one plus innings in the regular season, like very special situations. Like, I didn't love that he brought Hader in the eighth inning yesterday to clean up Presley's mess. Now, once you do that, you have to keep him in for the ninth. He does it a lot with Abreu. Like, he uses Abreu for the final out of like a sixth inning and then goes all of the seventh inning. Abreu is like leads the league in appearances, or at least amongst the leaders in the American League. Is that going to be something that they fill at the end of the year? I have some criticisms about how Espada handles the bullpen, but not his hook on his starter.
I honestly think that's him feeling a little pressure too about the fact that everybody's putting him under the microscope, and everything that Joe Espada does is going to be hyper-analyzed. And so he's making sure, I'm really going to get crushed if I lose this game because we were winning. So he's trying to cover his ass and win a game and do it that way, because I'm with you. I don't like the up downs. I don't like a guy that comes in hot out of the bullpen and gets you out of a jam, and then he sits through whatever you do offensively and then go, now go get it on eight pitches. Go get back out there and get it back up and do what you got to do. I don't think they're as effective. I don't think it's as good for your relief pitch. And to your point, Abreu's third in appearances in the entire league. And we remember what happened to Phil Maton at the second half of last season. Yeah. Phil Maton led the American League in appearances last year going into the All-Star break and then had dead arm basically most of the rest of the second half.
Don't love that comparison, though, because that's kind of Maton's strength. Like, Maton's strength is that he pitches in a lot of games. And he's not like one of your high leverage guys. Maton, like, the reason you have Phil Maton's on your team is because of a rubber arm. It's kind of like complaining about Brandon Belak throwing too many pitches. The entire point of Brandon Belak being on the team is that he's capable of throwing a lot of pitches. But I mean, I see where you're going there. It's just a little different whenever it's like your Haas in the bullpen versus like one of your inning eaters.
But even if you're a rubber arm and you're not a power arm like Abreu per se, he was still one of your more high. He was one of your higher leverage guys.
No, he wasn't. Maton. I mean, he wasn't your top three. He wasn't even your top. I mean, it was Presley. It was Neris. It was Abreu. Montero at times was a higher leverage than Maton.
But he was getting you out of a lot of situations, and he was being brought in like not fluffy situations for the majority of the first half. And no matter how much, I mean, 40-some or I forget how many appearances he had, but that's going to take its toll on any pitcher.
No, I agree. But, I mean, that's his versatility. Like, that's his value, is that he's capable of doing it. He's one of the guys you love in a bullpen because he's going to throw a lot of games. I think those are important to have, but they probably shouldn't be your top three leverage guys. 713-780-ESPN, HRMP listener line, 713-780-3776. We'll talk about Ryan Presley in greater detail in a minute. Just grade this nickname, 9681, the ugly Ryan Messley. Time to get rid of the Stressley moniker. He now creates big messes. So no more Ryan Stressley. Now it's Ryan Messley.
Kind of like it.
I actually think it's pretty good.
Perfect. Yeah,
I
like it quite a bit.
I'm going to give it an 8-1, which is pretty high grade.
From you, high grade.
I don't grade on a curve. Yeah. I like that nickname.
I'll give it a 7.5. I think it's very solid.
It's solid. 3-2-2-7. The good, the bad, the ugly equals hater contract. So I guess all of them, all of the above. Hater's contract is good. It is bad and it is ugly. I kind of see where you're going with that, actually, 3-2-2-7, because you can make the argument that it's not great to spend a lot of money on relief pitching. Good, can you guys imagine if they did not sign Hader this offseason? Presley would be a disaster as our closer, and then the bad Hader is an up-down season, ugly, give up the go-ahead bomb.
We can talk about that.
It was all Josh Hader there. That was interesting.
And Hader definitely needs to be on the bad, because like you said, if not for Presley doing what Presley's been doing lately, there would be a ton of fingers being pointed once again at Josh Hader and giving up another bomb. And that's just the nature of the business. When you come in on the big deal with all the anticipation, all the excitement, and all the money, it's the easiest guy for everybody to point fingers at, and he ain't doing great.
Yeah, he belongs on the bad. Yeah, to me, he's not on the bad below or before Presley. Any other bads? Any other bads? We mentioned Hader, Presley, Verlander, Dubon at third. Are we missing some bads here?
Was Montero considered bad?
I kind of come to expect that from Montero.
Yeah, and Abreu keeps setting his own mess, but then getting out of it. So you can't really say he was bad because he got you out of it, but he has a lot of traffic that's self-induced.
Yeah, he does. Keith from L.A. says that the bad is that the Astros only have a run differential of +6. Well, it's been in the negative for almost the entire season. So I'm good that it's +6, Keith from L.A. What is your good? What is the good that you have this from the weekend series? I have quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, I mean, look, Jordan is starting to be, and you called it. I mean, I was starting to doubt whether he was going to be able to put this team on his shoulders and carry them, but he's doing a lot again. He's finding his stroke. He's hovering around 300. He's hitting bombs. You know, he's getting multiple hit games, and he's doing the things that you have grown to expect out of Jordan Alvarez. So that's the first good.
Yeah, he's top 10 in the American League in slugging, OPS, and home runs. Like, the demise of Jordan Alvarez, to me, has been greatly exaggerated. I thought Jose Abreu had a good weekend.
He did. I didn't want to say it because, I mean, I was going to say the good is we didn't have to mention Jose Abreu in the bad or the ugly, but I was going to pad my brakes on the good, but you can't help it.
Well, yeah, if you didn't want to mention it, why did you jump in? Right before I was talking about Jose Abreu's greatness this weekend.
I'm just interjecting.
Sorry. 3-for-12 for Jose Abreu. Hit a dong, which, okay, he's got a little bit of life in that bat. I was more impressed with the double down the line. It's like he's turning. Now it was a hanging slider, but hey, he's hitting hanging sliders. Like, he wasn't hitting a whole lot of hanging sliders. He wasn't hitting a whole lot of anything for a good chunk of the season. So to see him turn, like, actually do some damage with a bad pitch. Okay, that's cool. A 3-for-12 at dawn, couple of RBIs, three runs. It kind of came in some big spots. Not the home run really didn't. The home run was more garbage time Friday night. But a couple of the other hits, the double down the line was in a big spot, scored on a double that I think tied the game or took the lead. There were some promising signs for Abreu. So that's good. The bad or the ugly might be that it might buy Jose Abreu more time into like July.
Facts.
So yeah,
that is complete and utter facts. The more that he does good, the more you people need to realize he's going to be around for longer, because it is going to fire up and encourage the Crane Gang, and they are going to force feed him into that lineup as much as possible.
Yeah. The Joe Abreu trade stock has gone up, says 3209. I don't think that it has. Time to trade him for anything. You couldn't trade Jose Abreu unless you're eating 95% of his contract at least. Framber Valdez continues to dominate. I asked Joe, I was here a little bit early today, I had some stuff to do. Joe came out during one of the commercial breaks, and I asked him, I was like, Joe, you still want to trade Framber? Because remember Framber, whenever he went rogue, Joe said that he wanted to trade Framber. Framber Valdez in his three starts since he went rogue, 205 ERA, 162 opponent batting average. He is looking like top five Cy Young Framber Valdez. Now, I do not think it's a coincidence that Victor Caratini has caught all three of those games.
No doubt about it.
And I started thinking more about this, too. Like, Framber Valdez goes rogue with Yiner Diaz. Remember Framber Valdez went into spring training saying he wanted to call his own pitches, thinking and knowing that Yiner Diaz was going to be the primary catcher on this team. I think Framber Valdez, without actually saying it, has showed us in two different instances that he doesn't trust throwing to Yiner Diaz.
No, and remember, he crapped the bed all over the place trying to call his own pitches in spring training, but they were like, oh, regular season, it'll be different. And then after the meltdown against the Angels...
Well, they ended it. I mean, he had one spring training outing, and they said, no more of that. Mm-hmm. Kiboshed it. No more.
Because it was awful.
Yeah.
And then when we were talking about this, basically because of the meltdown, I mean, I said, Caratini's got to be his catcher going forward because of the fact that he has to have a guy that's a psychologist or a veteran that has... that he has the respect of to be able to be put in his place. And I didn't think it was going to be every start going forward, but it seems like there's no coincidence that ever since Caratini became his private catcher,
yeah,
he's gotten a lot better results.
Yeah. I think this is a science project that's going to stick. I think Caratini is going to be Fromber's personal catcher. And I'm okay. You can even have a bigger conversation here and talk about his Yiner Diaz as a catcher, period. I don't think that they're doing that middle of the season, but I think going forward, this is going to be a real conversation that they have.
It's also because of the fact that we talked about, you don't have any wiggle room to keep screwing around. Whatever works at this point, ride it out until it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got the guy that you need more than ever now as your ace, your best pitcher. You got him righted between the ears. Keep rolling with it.
Hunter Brown over his last six games. This is Astro Future that compiled these numbers. I didn't compile him because I saw Astro's Future did it first and worked smarter, not harder. But it's last six games for Hunter Brown. So if the numbers are wrong, blame Astro's Future. A 2.91 ERA for Hunter Brown in his last six games. 34 innings. He has struck out 38, has walked just 11. Four straight quality starts. This is the Hunter Brown that we wanted. This is the, hopefully it's the, we don't know if it's the real Hunter Brown. Hopefully this is the real Hunter Brown. Like, Hunter Brown is looking like the prospect Hunter Brown we thought he was going to be, and I'm liking every bit of it.
No question, because we talked about his stuff being top level stuff in the majors. It's not one of these guys that you bring in and bring up and you're like, hope he's not a 4A player, hope he can at least be a decent starter in the big leagues. We knew from the get-go that this guy had electric stuff, that he had two pitches that translate to Major League Baseball. It was just about learning to pitch, controlling his pitches, and maybe not pitching, having as many pitches to choose from, because that knuckle curve cement mixer thing that got hammered all over the field was finally put in his back pocket. This is what you expect. A two hitter over six innings, seven strikeouts. The fact, like, he looked like he was in total command, and he wasn't trying to get, hey, make sure I, put all five pitches on display. Go with what works. Work the corner, pound the ball. If you have to work on the inside, you've got the fastball to do it. But that's the kind of stuff that you expect to see out of Hunter Brown.
Yeah, he was really, really stinking good. And he has kind of tabled that pitch that you hated, and he's added that sinker too. And right. I think that's what's led to this Hunter Brown, which hopefully it's the Hunter Brown that we can just become accustomed to. Because we just talked about how Verlander probably isn't a number two anymore in big league standards because, he's old, which is fair. If this is who Hunter Brown is, Hunter Brown could be a top of the rotation guy. Does he need to prove more of it? Yes, absolutely. But his last six starts, he is proving he can be a top of the rotation guy. Keith says, bad Paul Gallant driving skills. I saw pictures of that.
I did not.
I don't even know how to describe this. He went too far in a parking lot, and then like the parking lot. They should have been calling Third Rock Renewables and their mechanical concrete. But after the lot, there's a pretty steep drop off, and he couldn't get it back onto the parking lot, so he got
so
stuck.
The frame
there.
Got stuck on
yeah.
it. Oh,
yeah.
My God, how does that happen?
I don't know.
Was it alcohol induced?
I don't think so. It was in the middle of the day, which
well, it's
I
still
guess
possible yeah, depending on the day.
Good point. Any other goods before we
Yiner?
Yeah, Yiner belongs in this. Yeah, for sure.
He's hits in 6 straight games, kept the power going a little bit early streak. In the series, so yeah.
Yeah, he's all of a sudden hitting with pop. Like, it's amazing. And this little run that he's on, this heater that he's on, he's had more home runs than he's had the entire year. It's mm-hmm. bizarre. I think that there's something to be said about the 2 days off and catching a little bit less. And then Pena is starting to get back on track again, too. He had that lull where he was struggling, and then now he's starting to hit the baseball again, too, which is good. Altuve, streaky, he was very good in the series, too. So there were some good signs. There were some good signs. Hopefully Ryan Pressly was just a blip on the radar, and they can carry it over into San Francisco and continue to play some good baseball. We'll see. 713-780-ESPN. HRMP listener line 713-780-3776. Speaking of one Ryan Pressly, did Jim Crane ruin the former Astro closer? It's the Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Hey, before we go to the break, a word from our good friend Doc Linville. Doc Linville is the best in the business at the NeoGraft procedure. You ask, what is that? Well, if you're losing your hair, you've got pattern baldness, or you just don't have any hair where you used to and you want it back, Doc Linville is the answer, and the NeoGraft is the procedure that gets it done. He's fantastic. He has two procedures that can help you with your hair growth and to make sure that it looks the way you want it to instead of it looks like it's falling out. The first is PRP treatment, and the PRP treatment basically is like fertilizing your lawn. You have hair there, but it's not as thick and strong as it used to be. The PRP treatments can actually get it back to the way it was before you lose it, and now it's staying, and it's growing, and it's stronger, and it gives you a better appearance. But if that's not the answer because your hair's too far gone or it's already not there anymore, then the NeoGraft procedure is the one that I would recommend. It's the one that I did. The NeoGraft procedure is phenomenal because essentially it's taking hair from areas you never lose your hair. Genetically, you never lose the hair on the sides and the back of your head, no matter where else you lose it. He takes some of it and repurposes it where you need it most. In my case, it was my hairline up front. Other guys get the bald spot up on top and back. He takes care of all of that. And because you listen to us and you're interested in what he does, if you go to 975hair.com right now, you can get a free consultation with Doc and his staff. It normally costs $150. You get it for free. They explain the NeoGraft. You ask questions. They give you answers, and you see if it's right for you like it was for me. I did it, and the big game changer for me was 95 to 99% of all the follicles that he's going to move are going to stay, grow, and be with you for the rest of your life. That was all I needed to hear. But there's also lots of other bullet points that are going to make sense to you that are going to actually make it very enticing for you to do as well. Check him out today because you get the free consultation that normally costs $150 just by setting up the appointment at 975hair.com. I can't recommend it enough because there's nothing out of pocket, no signing on the dotted line, just you getting information that might help you get your hair back, and that's a game changer. Check him out. Go to 975hair.com today.
You're listening to ESPN 97.5. Broadcasting live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, it's the Killer Bees with Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
On ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Twitchers are commenting, Blankers, that you got a lot of sun.
They did.
You do look a little like this color of the brick. Out in the sun a lot this week?
Yeah. Yeah. A little too much softball coaching. And then thanks to that creating a farmer's tan, I overdid the... What do they call that? The
sunscreen?
Overcompensation to try and get the tan even?
Oh, no. Yeah, you shouldn't care. you shouldn't care.
If I showed you the line on my leg, and big mistake. I fell asleep at the pool yesterday while the kids were swimming,
oh, really?
Trying to even it up, and it doesn't feel great.
At this stage of my life, I don't care about farmer's tans. Like, I'm just going to have to deal with it. Did you not use the sunscreen?
I did.
SPF,
well, I did
not
the,
enough?
I did at the tournament. I did. At the pool, yeah. I was like, well, on the areas that I need to kind of catch up, I'll just not put any sunscreen on it. That was a mistake.
We think that Branham baby might be allergic to sunscreen, which isn't great.
You know what? The one that I am is I'm allergic to most bug spray.
Really?
So that's a pain, especially playing ball. Like, you know, you go and everybody else is spraying down with bug spray. And I know what's worse, the mosquito bites or the fact that my whole leg's going to break out.
Yeah, both aren't ideal. Who ruined Ryan Pressly? Do you think it's Jim Crane that has ruined Ryan Pressly?
I absolutely do. And you know, the more that we've had conversations and talked about the fact that, you know, relief pitchers, is it something when you are a closer and then you're demoted? And I remember Ken Giles said, you know, he couldn't do it if he didn't have the stress and the high leverage of a closing situation. But when you think about the offseason, and it is now more relevant because of what Hader has not done too. But when we were talking about Ryan Pressly, this is a guy that got the job done. Like last year, yes, there were some shaky times, but for the most part, Ryan Pressly was lights out for you. Ryan Pressly has been your closer for the last several years here and done a really, really good job. In the playoffs, he was essentially everything that you needed as a closer. He was your guy. He didn't do anything wrong. And then this offseason, Jim Crane decided, the way he likes to make big splashy moves, especially because we were talking about the fact that he hadn't done anything yet. We didn't know what he was going to do. We highlighted areas where he maybe should concentrate on it. But instead, his big splashy move that did everything that he wanted it to do and set us all aghast to go, wow. He went out and got the most expensive, big time, biggest name on the relief pitcher market in Hader. And when he brought Hader in, it essentially, the first thing after being excited about the Hader move and trying to analyze that was, well, what about Ryan Pressly? And then we had to hear how Espada had the meeting with both of them and they worked it all out. But if, like, you're doing your job in your regular everyday field and you're doing it really well and you know you're doing it well and you get demoted, it's going to wear on you. It's going to suck. And now it can take an effect. It can adverse effect on you. I think that the situation with Pressly has weighed on him this entire year. He's totally a different pitcher, as we know. When we saw him kind of snap out of this recently, it was when he got to close a game and he kind of found his stuff again. And now here we are again talking about him imploding once again. And on top of that, when you look at Hader, hasn't been great. Gave up another home run yesterday. He hasn't been nearly worth the money. And when you talk about that money and that $19 million a year and how you could have repurposed that if Pressly was still your closer and you could have fortified your bullpen, whether you kept Neris or one of your guys went out and got others, maybe had enough left over to still get a bat that would have helped fortify your lineup and your outfield, you might be in a way better position. And I think from the standpoint of looking how it affected Ryan Pressly, the Crane gang led by Jim Crane was the guy that had to have the best closer name on the open market. And I think it screwed up Ryan Pressly.
Would you say a 3.58 ERA is dominant?
As a closer, no.
It's what Ryan Pressly had last year as the Astros closer at the age of 34.
But so no matter what he did in the regular season, he was effective in the playoffs.
But you're saying that Hader hasn't been good based on the regular season, right?
As an Astro, that's okay. All we have. Like,
There's nothing you can argue with about Pressly's postseason success. Pressly's postseason success has been very, very good. But if you're building a team and you have a 34-year-old closer who's got a 3.58 ERA, it was 2.98 the year before. We've seen this kind of progress this way when it comes to Ryan Pressly. And there was even moments last year where they were talking about, not they, but fans were talking about it's time to demote Pressly. Brian Abreu is a more effective pitcher, which he was, than Ryan Pressly. So, like, this has been a conversation that's been going on for greater than a year. So Pressly hasn't been this dominant guy that, you know, in postseason he has been, but he wasn't a dominant closer last year. People wanted him demoted last season. He's also 34 years old. And we know that pitchers, as they get older and into their 30s, they regress. They move backwards. Now, was that the reason the Astros signed Josh Hader? I personally don't think so. Maybe it was part of the equation. I think it was more in reaction to the Kendall Graveman news than it was that we feel like Ryan Pressly's slipping and we need to add this, you know, another big arm to the back end of our bullpen. But I have, other than the money, like, I have no problem with them being aggressive and being like, Josh Hader is an upgrade over Ryan Pressly. Because quite frankly, he is. Josh Hader is a huge upgrade over Ryan Pressly. Josh Hader's been better than Ryan Pressly pretty much every single year for the last four or five seasons outside of the one bad season that Josh Hader had. Secondly, signing a closer has forced Ryan Pressly to lose velo, lose command, and allow other hitters to barrel him up. That's insulting to a veteran like Ryan Pressly, that he is so mentally fragile and weak that signing a closer that is an upgrade over him has now forced him to lose all command and to lose velocity on his fastball.
Look, I'm not saying that I can give you the answers and say, well, that caused that too. But I think that from a mental perspective, the fact is I think there's something there. I think from the simple fact on Hader alone, Abreu could, we talked about at the end of the playoffs last year, Abreu could be your closer in waiting. In a year or two, whenever Presley's deal expires, Abreu could be your guy. He could end up being your closer for the long term. But 5 years at $19 million a year for the number one closer on the market, I don't think was the right move for this team. At the same time, yes, you could have fortified your bullpen. Yes, you could have looked at other closers. You probably could have found them down the road and probably not to have to pay as much money. And you're right. There have been hiccups with Presley before, but that back of that bullpen at the end of the year was exactly what you needed him to be. And I don't think you had to go out and put 5 years on the board at $19 million a year. And in the process, also tell your closer, hey, you just got demoted. Deal with it. Hopefully you're cool with it.
If there's a reality where Josh Hader isn't signed and he has a 5.40 ERA, though, we'd have been like, what were the Astros thinking not signing a dominant or premier relief pitcher? Or even if you just took his, like you said, like 3.58 ERA is not very good, especially if you're 34 years old. Like, you would expect the 3.58 ERA for a 34-year-old to go backwards. So, like, you're comfortable just making that guy the closer for your team going forward when you have an opportunity to upgrade the spot. The money part of it is like, okay, should you use $19.5 million to sign a reliever, period, regardless of Ryan Presley's here or not? I think that is it's $19 million a year. I think it's a fair conversation to have. But I take exception to the Jim Crane ruined Ryan Presley when he was a 34-year-old with a 3.58 ERA and he's lost and he's lost velocity. Am I going to completely dismiss that it messed with his mental game at all? I'm not going to completely dismiss it, but is he the reason, Jim Crane, the reason that Ryan Presley's broken? I think it's insulting to Presley.
Well, that's great. You can think that, and I can think what I think. And I think that the fact that Jim Crane, who likes to just step in and play fantasy baseball, if you'd re-sign Neris, if you bring Neris back at a far less dollar figure and you have Abreu, and then Presley doesn't pitch like a guy capable of being a closer, well, you've got guys on your team that have closed games in the case of Neris that look like he can close games in Abreu coming off the playoffs, to where if he earns the demotion, that's fine. But at the same, because then you start the progression to getting where you think you're going to end up going anyway with Presley and with the bullpen. But instead, you went out and overspent to get that closer, didn't get any bullpen help, didn't get an extra bat. And I think that it was basically the team was the victim overall. But I think from a Presley standpoint, he didn't pitch bad enough to lose the job. He was demoted after pitching his tail off in the playoffs. And to some people, your psyche is affected. It can affect your overall performance. And I think that had something to do with it.
Okay. Yeah, I think that if that does it, and again, maybe potentially, yeah, we don't know what's going on. If that does affect his psyche, then he's incredibly soft. He's incredibly soft. And Ryan Presley was not a closer for his entire career. Some of his better seasons before the Astros traded for him was before he was ever a closer. In fact, he wasn't a closer immediately here. His best year as an Astro was in 2019. He wasn't a closer then.
Doesn't matter, Jeremy. You're not a vice president in a job for your entire career. But once you get there, you expect that that's where you're going to be. And when you're not, and it isn't basically performance-based, it's the fact that you got a shiny new toy, and so therefore you think that shiny new toy is better at doing the job than Ryan Presley, and you get shoved down. That's gonna depress some people. That's gonna piss some people off. That's gonna get less performance.
And I think those people are soft. Because I think the attitude you have is that was a terrible signing. I'm gonna show them and I'm gonna be better than that guy. 713-780-ESPN. What do you think? Did Jim Crane ruin Ryan Presley? 713-780-ESPN. It's the Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
You're listening to ESPN 97.5. You're back with the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Did Crane ruin Presley? 713-780-ESPN. 409 Josh, generally speaking, I think anyone being demoted at work could lead to a bad attitude and a negative impact on performance. I can see that that can happen. I think it could have the adverse effect as well, where, okay, I'm going to prove my worth and then maybe even move on after that. Like, let me go prove that I can still accomplish this role, and Ryan Presley's situation. I'm aspiring to be a closer again. Let me go dominate and get a chance down the road. 5199, Presley's postseason success in 2022 benefited from World Series winning defense. See Chaz catch in Game 5. Also got crushed on that Mancini ground ball to first. But, I mean, all's well that ends well. I'm not going to sit here and say that Ryan Presley's postseason heroics and dominance has been strictly because of defense. Presley's been fabulous, terrific in the postseason, so I'm not going to argue against that. 5199, Presley, there's no crying in baseball. He was pretty shaky in 2023. He's a year older now. 4478, Presley, he's been stress-free for nearly three seasons now. Last year, it seemed like every single time he came in, he was walking or giving up a leadoff double. He is incapable of a clean inning. If he came in with a three-run lead, he was giving up two. He was the third best closer option on the staff last year. That's probably true. Neris had a better year. Abreu had a better year. To me, it's more like, how are you losing velocity and command because somebody signed a closer and you got demoted? Like, how are you losing a mile on your fastball and your command goes down the toilet because your boss hired someone for your spot? Like, that's my hang up.
Well, I think from a command standpoint, that's part of just your mental approach to it, and maybe the fact that if you say you're hurt by it, or you got a little bit of I don't care in it, or however, and I understand you're a professional, you're supposed to go out and do the job, but it's a different mentality. You're right, but we saw, and to your point, we saw the velocity go down a year ago too, and then he somehow found it again, and it popped up a little bit mid-season last year. But I'm not trying to put that on the fact that the velocity going down is a factor in being demoted.
2022 four-seam fastball average 94.5, 23.94.7. So it was higher than it was the year before, and then this year it's down to 94, almost a full mile per hour. And the command is bizarre too. Like, he's missing spots on 0-2. Like, he's hanging breaking balls on 0-2. He drives me crazy watching him pitch right now, and I hate it. I hate it because I like Ryan Presley. 713-780 ESPN.
He didn't have those issues when he closed the one game last week.
That's an extremely small sample.
Right, I understand, but I'm just saying, to the standpoint of normally, if you lose command, you lose command.
You can find it for a three hitter stretch.
Right. Okay. But I'm countering it by saying, you know what? Normally, a guy that loses his command, it's across the board every time he makes an appearance.
No, it's spotty. It's inconsistent. Like, I mean, Hunter Brown has poor command. He doesn't walk every single hitter. Brian Abreu has worse command than Ryan Presley does. He's still pretty dang good. 713-780 ESPN. Let's go out to the HRMP listener line. Chris, you're in the Hive of the Bees. What's up, Chris?
Yeah, good afternoon, Branham and Joel. What's going on, guys? Hey, listen, for me, the good over the weekend was just seeing Yordan swing look pretty again. He's hitting the ball on the buttons, as they say. And so I really like seeing him get back into it the way he has. Yesterday in the seventh inning, I don't know if you guys talked about it, but for me, when he pulled Martinez out after two outs and the man gets to second base, I just feel like burning Montero for one out. I just could not believe it that he wasn't going to let Martinez try to get out of that. And you burn Montero for one out and kind of sets up the rest of the game as we saw it. So I didn't like that move one bit, and I just wanted to hear what you guys thought about it.
Yeah, I mean, I went back and watched the game, and I understand that a lot of people had an issue with Seth Martinez being taken out. I just don't trust Montero a whole lot right now either. But, I mean, I don't know how you feel about it. But, yeah, I mean, I think that's a factor in the fact that Joe Espada's, he's in kind of a panic mode right now with his bullpen instead of just using guys the way they're supposed to be used.
Yeah, I think it was a prisoner of the analytics moment where you're like, okay, this is a better matchup. If we have a better matchup, we better go to this guy. I probably agree with Chris, and now you're kind of burning an arm, and it's – okay, you know, if you save the arm there, maybe you can go an inning later in the game with Abreu instead of using him in that spot. Maybe you can avoid Presley altogether. So I'm wondering what the counter move would have been there, Chris. Like, if you're saving Montero for not getting that out, are you using him in the seventh inning and then using Abreu in the eighth and then Hader in the ninth? Like, I need to know what your next step would have been. I don't love burning a reliever there either. Now, you know, tight game, you're kind of managing a very specific way based on the matchups and the pockets. And, you know, before the game, when you see the other teams line up, this is a reliever, we like the matchup versus this hitter, et cetera, et cetera. I'm probably in line with you, but I'm curious what that secondary move would have been in counter to not, you're leaving Martinez in the game, but then are you still using Montero later or you're not using him at all? Because that really wouldn't have fixed the situation.
And avoiding Presley too is because he threw pitches the day before.
He threw 20-something pitches. And that's where I'm at with Presley. Like, you know, we can argue, like, what's the reasoning that Ryan Presley hasn't been very good. I think it's because he's a year older. I think it's because he's lacked some velo. I think the biggest issue is his command. You can get by on 0.7 miles per hour less on your fastball, but it does show regression in age. But the command, to me, has been the biggest issue. He can't spot. And you, to me, it's very obvious on 0-2 pitches. Like, Ryan Presley's throwing pitches in the zone on 0-2. A lot of times, they're breaking balls up in the zone. Last place you want a breaking ball in an 0-2 count. Last place you want a breaking ball, period. But the fact that you're missing that badly on 0-2 pitches is something that drives me crazy. So, I mean, we can talk about, you know, certainly we just did, like, what is the reason to blame for Ryan Presley? The question I have is, like, how do you use him now? Like, if you're Joe Espada, how do you use him? And I went back and I looked at all of the bad that Ryan Presley has had this year. And most of the time, because, like, to your point, pitching back-to-back days, is that something you should question Espada for? I absolutely think it is. We even had this conversation last year with Ryan Presley, like his bum knee and et cetera, et cetera. If you pull up Ryan Presley's game logs and you pull up Ryan Presley's splits, to me, it's like it's been an eye test thing, and I confirmed it with the numbers today. It's when Ryan Presley's pitching on back-to-back games, he doesn't seem to be nearly as good. Now, one thing that I uncovered is that whenever he has a long period of rest, let's say 3 days or more, he's also been very, very bad. So it seems like there's this window, and this isn't uncommon for older pitchers, I don't think. Like, there is this window of time where you should be using Ryan Presley. And it's 1 day rest, 2 days rest. If he's pitching back-to-back days, opponents are hitting 320 against him with an 866 OPS. When there's 1 day rest, opponents are hitting 208, 603 OPS. Much better. 2 days rest, they're hitting 100 against him with a 450 OPS. That is his sweet spot. 3 days of rest, 448 average, ooh, over 1,000 OPS. 4 days of rest, 400 average, over 1,000 OPS. 5 days of rest, the batting average is not bad, 167, but the OPS is 952 because he gave up a home run, small sample, and then 6 days of rest, I think it was like one appearance. There is a window where you can use Ryan Presley. He shouldn't be pitching back-to-backs anymore, and he shouldn't be pitching with 3 days of rest or greater. So really, you have this window. He has a day rest. He has 2 days of rest. That's the only time you can use Ryan Presley. Is that ideal?
No.
Is it a man? It is especially not ideal with a setup guy who's in a very designed role. Again, demote Ryan Presley. But is it manageable for a manager to do that? Yes. It's not that difficult. Like, you're usually using a reliever every other day anyways. Okay, no back-to-backs with Ryan Presley, and you have to use him with no more than 3 days of rest. That's not the worst thing to do. Now, is he going to pitch the eighth inning every time? No. But there's no issue there. No one wants to pitch him the eighth inning anyways. And then secondarily, is there going to be games where he's coming in where it's an eight-run lead or a five-run deficit because, like, you're forced to use him in this little window, a two-day window? Yes. But it's a small price to pay. Like, and these are the things that Joe Espada gets paid big money to do. So those are my Presley rules. Like, we have players that have these rules, Jordan, Caitlin Clark rules nowadays. My rules for Ryan Presley going forward, he's not pitching back-to-back days, and he's only pitching whenever he has 1 day or 2 days of rest. Anything greater than that is a mistake. So you have to force him into these games if you're looking like there's going to be a situation where he's resting that much.
And that's a difficult thing, taking out now where he has crapped the bed so many times that we're talking about demoting him, and then how far do you demote him? The fact is that you need a bullpen that's capable of kind of filling in those high leverage roles when Montero doesn't look great in lockdown. Abreu's got the stuff to be that, but he has created a lot of traffic lately. Got through most of it, and Hader's been, you know, Hader, but been better lately until yesterday. So now when he doesn't do that, because you're playing him in that specific pocket and you're only using him in those specific pockets, now you got to bump somebody up too. And who fills
that? Abreu for me, and it's easy. I mean, Brandon Abreu, he's allowed traffic, yes, and it's kind of sporadic when he allows traffic. He also had like a really dominant run before like the weekend. I mean, sub-3 ERA guy. But last year was sub-2. Year before that, he was sub-2. I think Brian Abreu is one of the better relievers in all of baseball. Yeah, he's my eighth inning guy.
Yeah.
And like some days, Presley's your seventh inning guy. Because, again, like, you're going to have him available 50% of the games. So, like, half the time, Presley's just your seventh inning guy. And, again, 1 day rest, 2 days rest, he's pretty stinking good still. He's still pretty stinking good. It's pitching back-to-back days where he's bad, and it's whenever he's gotten 3 days or more of rest where he's bad. So there's your window of time. He's probably still going to pitch. He's going to pitch all the time in those spans. Half the time, he's still going to have the seventh inning. Now, who is the guy whenever half the time that he's not it? You're probably playing the matchups. You're playing a Rafael Montero if the matchup indicates. You're playing a Martinez if the matchup indicates. They like Dubin against lefties. If there's a heavy lefty pocket, then he can have the seventh inning. I think it's more matchup-based than a specific name. Like, it depends. Like, you have all these managers who are either analytical, where it doesn't really matter their role. They're going to pitch against certain pockets, against lefty-heavy, righty-heavy, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have old-school managers, which Spot is more old-school than analytical, quite frankly. He has a hybrid of both, but I find him to be more old-school than analytical, where he likes guys in a set role, Hader in the ninth, Presley in the eighth, Abreu in the seventh. So this would be a hybrid of that. Your closer's still Hader. Brian Abreu's your setup guy. If Ryan Presley's available that day, then he's your seventh inning guy. Or what matchups indicate. Like, maybe you want Abreu to have the tougher matchup, but the tougher matchups in the seventh inning will give Abreu the seventh inning and Presley the eighth inning. That's okay. I like the analytical handling of the bullpen there. And then you'd have to play matchups, like, as you go further and further down the list with Montero, with Seth Martinez, with Taylor Scott, with Sean Dubin. But that's the plan there. Like, you can't afford to pitch Ryan Presley on back-to-back days, and you can't afford to give him 3 days or more of rest. It's proven in the numbers this year, and quite frankly, had the same issues last year.
Yeah, and the only thing that I throw into that too is that's all fine and dandy, but there's still no guarantees that's going to work. The numbers are definitely in the favor of that, but right now the way he's collapsed so many times, it doesn't give you the confidence even when he is in that pocket to use him in a high leverage situation.
Okay, would you rather use him in the eighth inning or 50% of the time in the seventh inning? Like, it's a less leverage situation.
I understand that. I'm just saying, for the overall betterment of the team, now you're also dealing with the fact that he has, you don't want to full Montero him when last year they completely just took him out of all leverage situations for a while to get him back and then slowly eased him back in. But that you still have to worry about the fact that no matter when he's used, no matter when he's supposed to be most effective, he just hasn't been effective this year. To your point about control and his fastball, are you concerned that he can still do those things?
So what's your plan?
I'm not saying the plan for right now is I am demoting him for sure. I no matter what, my eighth inning guy is now Abreu no matter what, no matter when Ryan Presley's available. And the thing is I still think his stuff is better than Montero. I'm not a big believer in Montero's stuff. But because of the results I've seen from Presley lately, I almost want to flip those two too for a while, though I don't have the total confidence in either guy. Ideally, I'd like him to go back into more of a Montero role where he can kind of find his command and get some confidence and then ease him back in. I don't have a total confidence that a Montero in the seventh is my guy.
Yeah, I don't either. Like, it's a pretty big drop off after the big two. Like, that's kind of the situation that Espada has to manage right now. 5199, Montero can handle up and down. He's shown it many times. Yesterday wasn't up down, though. He just got one out and he was done after a third of an inning. I don't want to use Presley at all. Can Abreu pitch two innings? Yes, he can. But, I mean, now you're talking about really taxing a guy. Like, he's already taxed, and now you're talking about taxing him even more. All right, 713-780-ESPN. Potential Achilles heels for the Texans. What are they? It's the Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
ESPN 97.5.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.